This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's issue, Owen Matthews discusses Vladimir Putin's endgame in Syria. He says Russia's bombing of Aleppo this week was intended to send a clear message that the Russian president is in charge. But Owen says Putin's strategy is his riskiest yet. What does it mean for the hopes of peace in war-ravaged Syria? And could it be a good thing, after all, if Putin's intervention does bring an end to the conflict? Joining Owen is Emeritus Professor of Russian History at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, Robert Service. Also in the magazine, The Spectator's political editor James Forsyth writes that Conservatives used to think a split in their party on the EU referendum would be a good problem to have, as it would have meant they had won the election. With that good problem now here ahead of today's EU summit, is it all turning into a bit of a mess? Downing Street is doing its best to put pressure on Tory MPs to back the renegotiation package. But with the likes of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson yet to say which way they'll stand, could the Tories' good problem be turning sour? With James to discuss is Charles Grant from the Centre for European Reform. And James Bartholomew, writing in The Spectator, says we've got it all wrong about left-wingers. He says they've actually got it pretty tough. James argues that those on the right should be offering left-wingers kindness and sympathy because they have to do without a whole range of pleasures, including golf, bridge and drinking fine wines. Joining James to debate whether we should hug a lefty is Rod Liddell. First up, what is Putin's endgame in Syria? Owen Matthews says part of Russia's plan in Syria is to distract international attention from unfinished business in Ukraine. But it is also more than that. He writes that Putin's intervention in Syria might be an act of reckless geopolitical buccaneering. But it's also worth considering, if Russia does help Assad win decisively and peace breaks out, is Putin's plan really so terrible? Is the devil we know better than the devil we don't? And is Putin on the brink of his biggest and riskiest coup so far? Owen is joined by Professor of Russian History at Oxford University, Robert Service. So, Robert Service, do you agree with Owen's argument in the piece that Putin's latest gambit might be able to bring peace to Syria after all?
I can see what he's driving at, and I can see the logic of what he's saying, because so little has been done of an effective kind by the other surrounding great powers. But I can't see the final result as being satisfactory. I mean, if Owen is suggesting that Syria would be best sorted out as a Russian protectorate, I just can't see it.
Owen, what do you think of Robert's argument there?
Well, I think you're completely right on one point, is that I think the end game is certainly not going to be easier, and it's not going to be as easy as Russia imagines. That's for sure. The problem is, I think we're dealing with a series of very bad options. And I think one thing is clear, that in the absence of any better plan, I think the Putin plan is the only one that's working. Whether it's actually desirable, I don't think anyone would agree that Assad is really a good thing for Syria, objectively. The only problem is that despite massive air support from the Americans, the so-called liberal rebels, or the moderate Sunni opposition, haven't really appeared, and they certainly there's no serious prospect of them winning. So it might not be a good thing, but I think it's probably the least worst thing. I think that's how I would put it.
Robert Service, do you agree with that, or do you think there is a better plan?
I agree with the idea that the previous attempts at solution have been a total mess. But the idea that this is in any way a positive alternative, I just don't see it. I think that's really the analysis that comes out of despair. There's one piece in the argument that you make, Owen, where you say, look at how Putin has stabilized Chechnya. Well, yeah, it's a stabilization of the graveyard. And Chechnya is a small little mountain republic inside southern Russia. Syria is a vast, vast country, and I don't see it being so easily stabilized. And would Assad be a Kadyrov, as in Chechnya, where, you know, a monstrous thug rules a tiny republic, rules over his own people in a monstrous way? Or would he be much more like Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan? Would it be like the Americans in Afghanistan, only it would be the Russians in Syria? I think it would be a pretty explosive so-called peace. That's the difficulty I have with your approach. For all of the agreement that I have with your negative analysis, I can't really go along with your semi-positive analysis.
So, Owen, how far can you take the Chechnya strategy as something that's extrapolated to Syria?
Right. Well, let's start with one thing. I think it's hard to accuse me of being strongly pro Putin or being strongly in favor of, or even of bringing Chechnya in as a positive example. I mean, you're certainly right that the Chechnya is brutal, but it's the kind of stability of the graveyard. Yes, I think my point is really not that Russia really wants to make it. It would necessarily be a good thing for Russia to make Syria a protectorate. I don't think there really is any interest in the Kremlin of taking over Syria in the same way that they took over Chechnya. The analogy only holds that's really the way they think. They think in terms in the terms of strictly sort of colonial, sort of brutal 19th century Realpolitik: divide and rule, ruthlessly crush the opposition that opposes you, support the tribes that are willing to go with you. It's a classic. It's like the British in Afghanistan in the 1840s. It's old-fashioned colonial politics. The question is, if we're talking about whether Assad is actually going to be able to effectively rule Syria after he's crushed the opposition on the ground, I think that's highly debatable. I think, but I think I would stand by one simple point, and that is that actually, in the current circumstances, where there's only really two parties in this conflict that really have a chance of reasonably winning, one of them is Assad, and the other one is ISIS and the al-Nusra Front. And I think faced with that extremely stark choice, it's a council of despair. Robert is completely right. It's a council of despair. It's not a good thing. But I think that Simon Jenkins in The Guardian, even he, no friend of tyrants, has argued that it's cruel and pointless to give the losing side false hope of winning, because the opposition are not going to win this war.
And the point that you make in the piece, Owen, is that the idea of backing a moderate opposition in Syria has been proved a fantasy. Why is that? How has that happened?
Well, sadly, because they just haven't been able to make any gains, even if they did exist. I mean, I've actually been down...
You don't think they exist either?
Well, they barely exist. I mean, I've been down to speak with several members of the Syrian National Council and various Free Syrian Army commanders and so on. And sadly, that they've actually failed to make any kind of significant impact on the war. And they've been able to disagree with them with each other. They've been unable to agree with each other in the various endless conferences that have taken place here in Istanbul, which I've attended as well. So I mean, there's no way that they're politically or militarily ready to confront the Assad military machine, and that's a sad thing. But unfortunately, that's the case. So we have to deal with the realities. And much as I'm loath to say it, Putin's plan, I think, is the least worst option in these circumstances. Is at least to bring an end to the war, and then deal with Assad later.
And Robert Service, what does this mean for the West? What's Obama, what's David Cameron's response to this?
I mean, Owen has just raised a whole nest of questions there. I mean, if Putin has a military solution, he surely doesn't have an economic one. He could pour oodles of treasure into Chechnya and stabilize Chechnya, but is that really going to happen at the moment with oil and gas revenues being depleted, with Western sanctions? Russia is in, as you say, I think in your article, is in an economic mess at the moment. It's not in a position to secure the reconstruction of Syria. Then what would happen if the West was invited in with its massive corporations? What would the Russians then do? They would have wasted their military effort in search of an outcome which would be the same as other places in the Middle East where Western military intervention has led to some kind of division of the economic spoils in Western interests. Russia doesn't want that. So I come back to this, that it's an illusion to think that a Putinoid military solution to the mess in Syria would actually be a stable solution.
You seem to be suggesting that Putin wants to colonize or somehow own Syria, but I don't think that's really the case. I think that he's just in it for sort of cheap geopolitical sort of bang for his buck. His military commitment has actually been extremely small. There's just one squadron of planes on the ground in Hem Amin, and they have they've lost so far one pilot over shot down over Turkey. So actually, I mean, it's not as though it's not an Iraq war situation where he's expended a huge amount of blood and treasure. And actually, I think if you're saying that the Putin is not in a position to pay for the reconstruction of Syria, and he's not in a position to assume a dominant role in Syria and the wider Middle East, I would strongly agree with you. I think you're right. But I think the difference is in our points of view, is that I don't think that Putin is really, A, cares that much about Syria or Assad. What he cares about is establishing Russian might, and Syria just happens to be a rather convenient way of getting an enormous amount of international prestige and clout for a very small outlay.
That was Owen Matthews and Professor Robert Service discussing Putin's endgame in Syria. It's now crunch time for the Prime Minister and his renegotiation package with the EU, as leaders of European countries meet in Brussels to thrash out the deal. The campaign so far has not exactly gone swimmingly for David Cameron, though, with a furious media backlash to the terms of his proposed deal. It now looks increasingly clear, says James Forsyth in his politics column this week, that the PM will have to fall back on broader arguments for EU membership rather than present his deal as a radical change. With James to discuss is Charles Grant from the Centre for European Reform.
So, James, what kind of mood is Downing Street in at the moment as it approaches the Brussels summit and the end of collective responsibility? Is everyone very relaxed?
Stressed, I think, is the key word. I mean, you have to feel for David Cameron in the simultaneous negotiations he is having to carry on. So he's having to negotiate with 27 other EU countries. He, on Tuesday, was trying to negotiate with the leaders of the European Parliament, and he's having to negotiate with his own cabinet and other Tory big beasts like Boris Johnson to try and limit the number of Tories who end up backing out. You know, the lobbying effort is so extensive now that George Osborne is texting Tory backbenchers saying, can you please call me? And they don't realise it's him. I mean, this is a proper effort to limit the number of Tories who back out. Because I think Cameron, unlike quite a lot of people in Number 10, is very, very jumpy about the result of this referendum. Some people in Number 10 think, look, the country's risk-averse, it's ultimately not going to vote out. Cameron himself is very nervous about the referendum.
And Charles, do you really think it matters how many Tory backbenchers back in or out, given it's one vote for each person and given the deal will be presented to the country in the next few days? Why does it matter?
I think it does matter how many Tory MPs actually back the Prime Minister on this deal, because if, say, three-quarters of Tory MPs back him, that'll affect the way the Tory press report on the referendum. It'll affect the tone of the debate. And if, on the other hand, the Tory party split down the middle, it'll be much harder for Osborne and Cameron to persuade voters that it's really a good deal. Now, of course, the deal is only the deal, and people will move on beyond the deal and focus on the benefits of being in or out in the long run. But at the start of the campaign, if large parts of the Tory party say it's not a bad deal, I think that'll help the Prime Minister enormously.
Do you think the deal is a decent enough deal for Tory MPs to be confident that they're backing something worth selling?
Well, we don't know what the deal's going to be yet.
In terms of what it's shaping up to be.
At the moment, it's probably not going to impress very many Tory MPs, but I think Number 10 hopes to surprise on the upside. There's a lot of gloom in the press at the moment from those sympathetic to the Prime Minister saying, oh, well, it's unravelling. Various achievements of the draft deal of 2 weeks ago are not going to be in the final deal. I actually think the final deal will look pretty good and there are going to be a few surprises in it.
James, do you agree with that?
Look, I think that, weirdly enough, the hostility of the press reaction in some ways helps Cameron, because in some ways he can turn around to the other 27 leaders in the room and say, look, if I'm going to win this referendum, I can't dilute this any further. Indeed, if anything, I need a little bit extra. I think, though, you see this as the interesting thing is where the domestic politics bump into each other, where they collide. So, for example, child benefit. You know, for these Visegrad group countries, you know, the idea that people who are currently sending their child benefit home are going to have to stop doing so is a political problem. So it is probably going to have to just be for new claimants. So I think you see these kind of rows are when the domestic politics coincides. And then I think this ever closer union thing, I think, will be fine. You know, this idea that the Belgians will cause trouble. I think that those kind of theological arguments will end up not being problematic. It'll be things where politicians fear the domestic reaction to the British changes, where things will get sticky.
Charles, you don't look as though you agree with that.
I think on the ever closer union thing, I think it could cause a big amount of trouble, because don't underestimate the passion of Belgian federalists to achieve a federal Europe that doesn't allow countries to opt out of it. I mean, there will be a big row on whether that particular part of the deal can be enmeshed in a future treaty change, a promise of treaty change to exempt the British from ever closer union. Belgians will fight hard against that.
Because I read the Tusk letter as not exempting the British, but just redefining it in a particular case of Britain, which seemed to me like a kind of classic compromise.
Yes, the words are acceptable to the Belgians, but one of the key issues for the summit is which bits of the deal do you put into a future treaty change. But there'll be a promise, there may be a promise, I think Cameron will get this, if for two or three provisions, say, next time the EU treaties are changed because of an accession of the new member state or because of the Eurozone governance rules being changed, the next time they're changed, can we put into the new treaties some bits of our deal to make it absolutely watertight, particularly on the break, the so-called emergency break on migrants' benefits, to prevent future challenges before the European Court of Justice. Cameron wants that in the treaties.
I think one of the other fascinating questions that Charles would probably have a better view on than me is this break allowed to be pulled again and again and again? I think this is one of the big things. I mean, if Cameron can sell it as we can carry on pulling this break for years and years to come, then I think it's a much bigger deal than if the idea it can be pulled once, because it was a response to Britain not having transitional controls, unlike most other European countries. You know, if you can only pull the brake once, I think it's a much less attractive thing to sell to the public.
Charles, what do you make of the brake?
Well, I think Cameron will get the period for which the brake can apply extended from the 4 years to something like 7 years. I don't know if he's going to get it put into treaty change. I don't know the answer to James's question about whether it can be pulled more than once. I think that might be difficult. But what I hear from officials in Brussels is this. They've given Cameron his four-year opt-out from in-work benefits, which is very, a very difficult demand. People like me said he would never get that. And they're annoyed that Cameron and Number 10 have not managed to spin that as a great success. They all thought this was the one thing they needed to do to give Cameron a good deal. He's got what he asked for, more or less, on the in-work benefits, and now the press has still reacted very negatively.
And James, in your column this week, you say that part of Cameron's problem is that what he has conducted isn't so much a renegotiation as a reordering. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think to be fair to Cameron, this isn't what he said he was doing, but I think when most Tory MPs and certainly most voters heard renegotiation, they thought this was going to fix whatever irked them about the EU, whether it was free movement or the common fisheries policy or whatever. Whereas what Cameron and Osborne were actually trying to do was they were trying to answer this question that Peter Mandelson posed in a speech a few years ago, when he said, look, you know, actually the choice is between fully integrating, joining the euro, or leaving. They're trying to say, no, there's a third way, where you can be in the EU but not in the euro. And that's why Osborne's always thought that the Eurozone ins and outs part of the deal was far more important than any of the welfare stuff. So I think the problem is that the word renegotiation implied to a large chunk of people, oh, we're going to fix whatever we don't like about the EU. And it hasn't done that. Instead, what it's trying to do is kind of find a kind of future way forward that Britain could exist in an EU which is increasingly dominated by the Eurozone.
So does that mean then that it is impossible to reform Europe in a way that would address those irks that the British people thought Cameron was going to address in the first place, Charles?
Well, I think Cameron's mistake has been to see himself as an alchemist who can transform lead into gold. His line has been the EU's a pretty ghastly thing. With my reforms, it'll become pretty good. And the truth was he was never going to be able to change it, at least not that quickly. The EU is a very slow-moving, conservative, cumbersome set of institutions that cannot change quickly. As somebody who hopes Britain stays in the EU, I would have liked him to have said the EU actually is a pretty good thing for all its faults. And with my reforms, I can make it somewhat better incrementally. That would have been an honest and true approach. He hasn't taken it. He's set too much store by his own negotiation. He hasn't changed anything very dramatically. The negotiation, and now he's in a bit of a fix.
Doesn't sound like you're very happy with him then.
Well, I think given the constraints he's been under, he's achieved probably the reforms he could have achieved. I don't think if he'd banged the table and shouted and screamed and tried to handbag people, he would have got a lot more, but he was never going to achieve a huge amount. I'll give him credit on one thing. He's not a natural diplomat. He's not somebody who easily builds relationships with other leaders. He hasn't, in his first term of office, invested hugely in relationship building in Europe, hasn't travelled enough. In the last 6 months, or 4 or 5 months, he's actually made up for that. He has learnt about diplomacy. He's got on an aeroplane. He's eaten humble pie and gone to talk to leaders of obscure Southeast European countries, hoping to get his deal. I think he's learning diplomacy, but rather late in the day.
And James, what difference does it make if Cameron finds that he does actually have a cabinet big beast opposing him leading the Leave campaign?
I think it makes a difference in this sense, which is I think it matters a lot for the referendum campaign which out campaign gets the designation. If it is the grassroots movement, which is this, which is dominated by kind of Nigel Farage, Peter Bone, Philip Hollowbone, it's going to be very easy for Number 10 to say, look, it's a bunch of cranks and gadflies who want to get out of Europe. These are people who, you know, want to take Britain back to the 1950s. It's very easy for them to attack that kind of campaign. If it is Vote Leave, which is going to do this kind of more future-focused offer of Britain outside, then I think that is slightly more difficult. And I think the nature of a campaign is going to be, you know, the Electoral Commission is going to be hugely important in determining what kind of campaign we have and possibly what kind of result we have. I mean, I've always thought that In would win, but without much public enthusiasm. But one number this morning gave me pause on that, which is in the first 6 weeks of this year, 25 times as many people crossed the sea into Europe than they did in the first 6 weeks of last year. It does make you think that if the migrant crisis was to be 25 times worse by the time than it was in June last year, by the time of the referendum, then I think the result really could be in doubt.
And finally, what do we expect to hear from cabinet ministers over the next few days after the deal, if the deal is indeed signed, about their stance? Are they being told how to declare their position?
Yeah, I think Number 10 would be very unhappy if anyone pulls a Heseltine and holds a little press conference in Downing Street announcing that their decision to campaign for out. I think the feeling is that the cabinet should meet, everyone should go their own separate ways, and then people should say which way they stand. I think there is a chance that we won't know where, when we go to bed on Friday night, we will not know where every single cabinet minister stands on the deal, because I understand that they will go round the table, but they won't force everyone to speak. It'll only be if you want to. So some people might keep their powder dry and, you know, want to sleep on it before they make their final decision. I think one thing which is Charles be uniquely well qualified to talk about, which is one thing that's very amusing about this, watching Boris Johnson's indecision, is that if you look at these aspects of this deal, like the role of the European Parliament in this, this is the kind of story that Boris Johnson would have made merry hell with as a Brussels correspondent. He would have infuriated Number 10 by finding some obscure MEP who is promising to rip up the whole thing. Mm. You know, and I think that one of the things that is so difficult for Boris is he can see journalistically how he would have approached this deal when he was a Brussels correspondent. Mm-hmm. Yet there is some element of him emotionally that still wants to be, and I still think he will end up backing staying in.
That was James Forsyth and Charles Grant discussing crunch time for the UK in its negotiations with Europe. And finally, is life tough being a left winger? James Bartholomew says it can be miserable for those on the left because they have to do without so many of the good bits of life. He argues that lots of things are out of bounds to lefties because it risks making them look like hypocrites.
Champagne is the no-no, and so too is golf and having a second home. It's also risky going on a skiing holiday. And as for fine wines, just forget it. Joining James to discuss whether it's time to put a consoling arm around a lefty is Rod Liddle. James, you say in your piece that left-wingery is a struggle against nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean that there's something in the human being that wants to have fun, you know, like the girls just want to have fun. And, you know, that must be in everybody, not just in people on the right. And the left wing must have to quash it. You know, it's really, really sad.
So, Rod, you're a Labour member. Is your life really as miserable as James suggests in his piece in this week's magazine?
It's probably slightly more miserable. I think he's got it absolutely bang on. The problem is, and I think what James is referring to is less actually the true left, but the sort of liberal left. And it's become such an absolutist creed that it sort of governs every single thing you do. It governs your diet, and it governs the way you react to other people. It governs whose friends you're allowed to be, and as James says, it even governs what sport you're allowed to like. It's an incredibly it's a bit cultish. There's something cultish about it. It affects everything, and James is right. I mean, we do have sex, incidentally, but it's very, very, very dull sex. That's you know, left wing sex is you need consent forms and stuff. You know, it just isn't the same as normal people having sex. It's in a completely different sphere, and people who weren't left-wing would be appalled by it. And it affects, yes, of course it affects your clothing. There's also brand names and stuff like that which you're not allowed to wear. It's this more absolutist mindset, which maybe does come from Marx in the sense of historical determinism and all that sort of stuff. But there was a bit of research done recently which said that on Facebook, for example, you are highly likely to be defriended by a liberal lefty for something you'd said, whereas right-wing people on Facebook couldn't give a monkey's. Live and let live. You've got that view, I've got this one. If you have that other view, you can no longer be a friend.
That was James Bartholomew and Rod Liddle on whether we should feel sorry for lefties. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of The View from 22. To listen to more of our podcasts, visit our website at www.spectator.co.uk/podcast. Alternatively, to subscribe to the podcasts in iTunes, search under podcasts for The Spectator. And podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. The landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.